First of all, thank you very much to Orsemer and to all the local Orsemer friends and helpers for making this evening possible, and for, in general, allowing me to come to Chicago and work like a slave. We've heard two wonderful talks this evening about our relationship with each other and relationship with Hashem in the run-up to Shavuot, the receiving of the Torah. Let's turn our focus now to an aspect of Torah itself. And in doing so, I hope we'll understand something about Jewish fundamentals and change perhaps our perception of our connection with Torah. And I'd like to look at that through the eyes, or through the facet, if you like, through the aspect of Torah that is represented by Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. Because really the Torah is transmitted through him, it's called his Torah, and it's axiomatic and fundamental in Judaism to understand his position. In fact, one of the problems in this area is to understand why we need an intermediary in the first place. What does that mean, and how is Torah refracted, as it were, to us through him? I think a way to begin is this. You know that in the Rambam lists 13 fundamentals. Not always pays to study basics, fundamentals. If those are strong, the rest flows naturally. These are printed in any siddur. And the Rambam lists 13 fundamentals. Each, of course, needs full discussion. But there's one that's very perplexing that I'd like to focus on a little bit this evening. And that's the seventh one. The Rambam says like this. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with these creedal statements of Judaism, 13 principles that the Rambam constructed. The phrasing we have in the Siddur is not the Rambam's own words, but one of his contemporaries or someone who lived shortly after him phrased it in this particular fashion as statements of belief. Ani ma'amin be'emunah shleimah, I believe with a perfect faith that Hashem exists and conducts all that happens in the world. Second, that he is one and there's no oneness like his. Third, that he has no corporeal element, he has no body. Fourth, that he is first and last. Fifth, that he alone is the one to whom we relate. In other words, no intermediaries, pray only to Hashem. Sixth, ani ma'amin be'emunah shleimah, I believe with perfect faith, shekol divrei neviim emes, that all the words of the prophets are true. Seven, ani ma'amin be'emunah shleimah, I believe with perfect faith, shenevuas Moshe Rabbeinu, that the prophecy of Moses, alav shalom ha'isa amitis, was true, and that he was the father of all the prophets, both those who came before him and those who came after. Obviously, we're not talking about father in a chronological sense. We're talking about an archetype. He's the root of the concept of prophecy, as it were. All that is spoken in the name of all prophets really comes through him. But what's perplexing about this is that the sixth principle says that it's fundamental that to believe and to know that all the words of all the prophets are true. Why do you need a seventh one that is a statement of the idea that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is true? Surely that is contained in the sixth. Once you've already said that you believe that all the words of the prophets are true, that certainly includes Moshe Rabbeinu. If there's any prophet, it includes it, certainly him. What is the meaning of the seventh one that you have to state as a separate principle that Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is true? What is added here? And why is it necessary to have it as a separate principle? That's the question. I think in order to approach this question, let's make it even more difficult. And in doing so, study a deep theme behind these fundamentals. A very basic question about this list of 13 articles of faith is, where did they come from? You know, it's embarrassingly simple question. Maimonides, the Rambam, who assembled this list of 13 things, is a codifier. He assembles and he collates and he edits and he brings down sources. Where did he get these from? If you look in the text of the Torah, you will not find any place that 13 fundamentals are listed. There's no place that the Torah lists 13 principles. There's no Mishnah that lists 13 principles. Where did the Rambam get them from? We're talking about basics here. We're talking about fundamental principles. We're not talking about details and peripheral aspects. Where on earth did the Rambam find 13 articles of faith if we have no text that suggests it? There are suggestions. There are commentaries who say that these 13 are philosophically fundamental. In other words, you need these 13 things because these are obvious axioms. If you don't have a relationship with Hashem, then nothing else moves. And if your understanding of what God is flawed, you think that he's more than one, you think that he has a physicality, that's tantamount to saying that there's no God. But I don't think that's really the Rambam's source. I think if we search, we will find that in fact there is a textual source. You know, you could put this question differently. Where did the Rambam, which text in Torah, in Torah itself, in the written law, in the Mishnah, in the oral law, which text did the Rambam use to derive these 13? But you could put the question another way. If they're axiomatic and basic in Judaism, why does he not rule them in his halachic work? If you look through the Rambam's entire codification of Torah, there's no place that he lists these 13 things as requirements. So we have a double-edged sword here, if you like, of a question. One is, what is the source of these 13 things in the Rambam? And secondly, if they are so fundamental, why does he not bring them into halachic expression? Why does he not rule them in his text, in his code? And I think the answer to that is as follows. There's indeed a source for these 13 things. And of course, it is in the Rambam's halachic code. And let me read it to you. Here's the source. This is in the Laws of Tshuva, Hilchos Tshuva, in the third chapter. This is scary, scary stuff, but time leading up to acceptance of the Torah, have to face reality. And this is what the Rambam says. He lists in the Mishnah, he collates or culls from the Mishnah a number of categories of people who are so negative, that means whose misbehavior or whose level of transgression is so serious that they have no spiritual life left at all. Right? In the terminology, Torah terminology, they are cut off. Karis, which means some sort of excision. And that means that there's no, you could put it like this, they have no share in the world to come. This is Rambam's language. These are people who have no share in the world to come. These are people who are cut off and lost. They are judged for the enormity of their sin, their transgression. Forever and ever and ever. Forever, I mean this is, I said it was scary, but it's really scary. Forever and ever and ever. You know, the Rambam never duplicates a word or adds an extra word. Here you have three in a row. Okay. Something to think about. I mean, of course, the Kabbalists explain, and the Gemara brings that as a source, that lo'olam does not really mean forever. Lo'olam means for the world. So there's some sense of worlds here during which a person is cut off. But whatever it means, it's a very serious consequence. Which are the people who have no share in the world to come? What can a person do that detaches him or her from a spiritual existence? And the Rambam lists them. He says that these are people who are called minim, very hard to translate. Let's call it atheists in some sense. Aprikosim, deniers. Kofrim b'Torah, people who deny the Torah. And he goes through a whole list of categories of people who have no share in the world to come. I mean, you know, once we're scaring ourselves, we might as well terrify ourselves. So, you know, he includes here, for example, Balei Lashon Hara. That means you speak badly about people, you're in this category too. It's right up there with murderers. He goes on to say it includes people who use unkind nicknames. That means you call somebody by a derogatory nickname, right? You coin such a name for a person, or even if you simply use a name that a person has. And we're talking, of course, about a derogatory nickname. We're not talking about, you know, calling your wife Cookie Face or whatever you may call her. But we're talking about, you know, something that's insulting. Those are very serious things. They cut a person off from the world to come. But when the Rambam goes into detail, he explains what each of these categories involve. And I'd like to read you the first few. The first category the Rambam calls minim, right? Very hard to translate literally. But here's his definition of minim. Listen carefully to this. Somebody who says there's no God and the world has no master. In other words, the Rambam's telling you here that a person who attacks this, a person who denies this, a person who says that the world has no creator and there's no master to the world, these two terms, the difference between them is creator means basically the origin of space and manik means the origin of time. In other words, the creator of all things that exist and the one who masters their progress through history, those two dimensions, that person has no share in the world to come. What do we see in the first of our principles? Animam in bimrushlem, I believe with perfect faith, that Hashem is Borei Umanig Lekol Abruim. He's the creator and the master of all that exists. Exactly the same terminology, but phrased in the positive. In other words, in the Rambam's code, he's telling you that anyone who denies these things is cut off from a higher existence. The principle, the statements of principle that the Rambam has is simply the positive phrasing of this negative. Let's examine a couple more. The second one. Somebody, the first person is a, the first is somebody who says that there's no creator. The second, somebody who says there is a master of the world, but he's two or more. Listen to the Rambam's second statement of faith. I believe with perfect faith that Hashem is yachid ve'en yichidus kamoh. He's single and there's no oneness like his. The positive statement of what he lists here as the negative. The third, somebody who says there is one master of the world, but he has a body or some diagram or some image. Third principle of faith. I believe with perfect faith that Hashem has no body and no image. It's exactly one for one, the converse of what we have here. The fourth one. Somebody who says that there is a creator of the world, but he's not the first and the first cause. The fourth principle. I believe with perfect faith that Hashem is first and last. Did I convince you? Yes? In other words, you have here a clear source. The principles, the articles of faith that the Rambam lists, these 13 articles of faith, they are simply the positive phrasing of the items that he brings in his halachic code, that negative, that means transgression of which, cut one off from the world to come. You know, I would say, put it like this. You could say that there are certain vital organs in the body, right? You could say certain parts of the body can be injured, will not be a lethal injury. The other parts of the body, jugular veins, carotid arteries, coronary arteries, parts of the body that a small injury there might be lethal. Those are vital organs. But you could say it in the positive. You could say to somebody going into battle, take care to guard your vital organs. You could phrase it either way. In his halachic code, the Rambam brings 13 categories of things, transgression of which cut one off from the spiritual world. The articles of faith are simply the warnings, if you like, the injunction, the caution, that which one must remain attached to in order to protect the vital organs. And therefore, there's a clear source for these 13 articles of faith. If one is asked, where do we have a source for 13 articles of faith? The answer is, the Torah does not list 13 articles, but it lists 13 warnings stipulating what the vital organs are. In other words, in order to be attached to that spiritual world, there are these categories of things that are vital. There's one that does not correspond on both lists, right? Like to set you a small homework problem, right? If you get this right, Bruce is going to buy you a whiskey. Or cocaine, whatever you're into in Chicago. And it's this. If you check through this list, I didn't read all of them, but you'll find that there's a one-for-one correspondence. But there's one that appears in one list and not the other. And I suggest you like to think about that as a homework exercise, a very illuminating exercise. And that's the principle of reward and punishment. In the Rambam's listing of 13 articles of faith, he very clearly lists as the 11th principle, reward and punishment. Here it is. I believe with perfect faith, Shabaris Brachmoy Gemel Tov L'Shemer Mitzvesov, that Hashem rewards those who keep his mitzvahs, Umanish L'Ovre Mitzvesov, and he punishes those who transgress them. A very clear statement of reward and punishment. It's completely missing from the list of origin. If you look here in the laws of Tshuva, you'll find that the Rambam, he has 13 as well, because he splits one of them into two, so there's a correspondence in the number. But completely absent from the list of punishments, of warnings, if you like, is the doctrine of reward and punishment. What does that mean? Why is there one-for-one correspondence in all of these? That means for every positive statement of faith we have an origin in a negative statement, in other words, a warning of spiritual damage. But the doctrine of reward and punishment, which you are required to believe in as an article of faith, there's no warning that if you're missing it, you'll be spiritually doomed. What does that mean? What is the meaning of an article of faith that is essential to know, and yet if you're missing it, there's no damage? Very strange idea. It's unmistakable that the lists correspond, and yet there's one of them that is missing on one side. I'm not going to go into that now, but I suggest that there will be a very fruitful exercise for thought. What do we learn from this? We see here that these 13 articles of faith are not just fundamental philosophical principles. They're spiritual life and death. That means if a person's missing one of these, it's not just that you're missing a philosophical fundamental. It means that there's an excision. That means that person is detached from the spiritual world in some eternal sense. You know, it's even worse than that. The Rambam famously holds that a person who's missing one of these, even accidentally and unintentionally, is detached. I mean, that's really scary. I mean, fortunately, many others don't hold like that, and we take a more lenient view in general. But he famously holds that a person who denies one of these, or doesn't know one of these things, not because he's detaching himself deliberately, but even if you were simply never taught them, is detached. You know, if you eat poison accidentally, you're accidentally dead. You know, it's not a question of what you deserve. These things are, in fact, one's connection to a higher world. If you're missing the connection, there's no connection. Again, there are others who say it's not like that, that every person is naturally connected, that unless you excise yourself and cut yourself off, that connection remains. But what we take away from this discussion is that these 13 fundamentals are one's attachment to the spiritual world. And therefore, when you have the sixth principle, that the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moses' prophecy, the sixth one, that the prophecy of all the prophets is true, and then you have a seventh one, that Moshe Rabbeinu, the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu is true as a separate principle, an unavoidable conclusion here is that if a person knows that the prophecy of all the prophets is true, but he refuses to believe that Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moses, is categorically different than the others, that there's a separate attachment to his prophecy, that person has no spiritual life. That's what it says. That means that if you have all of these, you know, to be excised spiritually, to be spiritually dead, you need to be missing just one of these 13, not all of them. One's good enough. One vital organ cut spells death. And therefore, what we're saying here is a person who knows all 12 of the 13 principles, and he knows that all the prophets are true, including Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is true, but he doesn't know that Moses' prophecy lives in a different category, that person has no spiritual life. That's an extreme conclusion. What does that mean? In order to understand this, there's an amazing discussion in commentary on Torah, which I think is so exceptional that if you don't appreciate this, I would say basically there's no hope for you. And that is a discussion we find in a work written by the son of the Rambam, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam, in a printed together with a book that he wrote called Sefer HaMaspik. In fact, today it's been reprinted, and I saw recently even an English translation come out. Together with that, he has a commentary on the Torah, at least on the first two books of Torah, Bereishis and Shemos. And he brings down an explanation of a problem in Chumash that he himself praises enormously, and it's very unusual to find our authorities of that age praising something that they say. And let me share with you that discussion. I'm not going to read through the text for you. I urge you to go home and look it up, because the words are, his explanation is exquisite in terms of this, how specific the words are. But let me run through the discussion and show you what he says. Here's the problem, and then I'll share with you his insight. The problem's like this. When Hashem appears originally to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses, and speaks to him, I'm sure you're familiar with the conversation. God appears to him and says to him, I want you to go to Egypt and speak to Pharaoh and speak to the Jewish people, and you be the Redeemer. And Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Hashem and he says, but I cannot speak normally. Hare ani aral svasaim, I am of uncircumcised lips, I cannot speak. And therefore I cannot do the job. By the way, you know, the Maharal points out that his imperfection of speech was in fact his perfection. He wasn't the person with a problem. The Maharal explains that his difficulty in speech was a manifestation of his perfection. He was living in a world where things are grasped in such depth, with such infinite connection, that they cannot be brought down and packaged in finite words, in mere words. The reason he couldn't speak was because, you know, real wisdom, things of real meaning and depth, can never be put in words. Can't speak out things as you really understand them. Technical things you can speak, but the meaning of things, things that live beyond technicalities, those can never be put into words. Words always lie. Even the best and most articulate words are only small and finite, limited packages. This is why two people can never really communicate in words, right? Because the words are always inadequate. In fact, the only way you can really share something deep with someone else is when you understand each other so deeply that you don't need words. When half a gesture is good enough, then you understand each other. But if you have to start explaining at length, there's almost no hope of getting it across. People live together for 50 years and then begin to realize they never understood in the beginning what the other person really meant. I mean, that's usually a man's problem. Women understand despite what you say. That's another issue. But the words are always limited. And you know that, you see this in many ways, you know that many people who lived through the European destruction never spoke about it ever. Many people will tell you, you know, my grandmother, she would never talk about it at all. Young people misunderstand that. They think that the people who went through that horror didn't speak about it because it was too painful. That's not the reason. They didn't speak about it because they couldn't. How do you put that into words? Where do you begin? How do you say it? Something beyond human conception. And of course the converse is true too. When someone's been through a pain too deep to bear, if you can get them to start speaking, it makes it bearable. It's a very good therapy. Once the words begin to pour out, it takes on a finite dimension. Words are always like that. Words are always a limitation, bringing down into the finite. The reason we use a shofar in Rosh Hashanah is because we're going to a depth beyond words. Words can always be misunderstood, but there's no misunderstanding the scream of a child in the night. The shofar goes all the way back. The word shofar in Hebrew is the same word as shafir. Shafir means the liquid that the child is contained in the womb, right? The membranes and the liquid when a child is born. The shofar takes you all the way back to that primal situation, to the true self before the details have begun to manifest. And therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't speak well because he was holding in a world where things are in all their infinite depth and greatness and attachment. But be that as it may, he couldn't speak. So he said to Hashem, you're sending me to say a message and to be a spokesman, but I cannot speak. So Hashem said, don't be concerned about that. I will send you with your brother Aaron, and Aaron will be your spokesman. He will be hu yelcha lepeh. He will be a mouth for you. Vatat yelo lelokim, and you will be to him an Elohim. That word means very hard to translate. Normally, that word is one of Hashem's names. But here the commentaries say it means some sort of an angel. You'll be an emanation of angelic power to him, whatever that word means. And that is the resolution of the problem. In other words, the conversation is, Hashem says, Moshe, go and tell Pharaoh the following message. Moshe says, Hashem, I cannot speak. Hashem says to him, don't worry, Aaron, your brother, will speak for you. What's not often realized is the conversation continues. Because that's in Pasha Shmos. But if you look in Va'ero, the conversation continues. Moshe Rabbeinu turns again to Hashem and says to him, but Hashem, I cannot speak. And Hashem says, your brother Aaron will speak for you. And there the language is, Va'aron achicha yeh nevi'echo. Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet. He will be your prophet. And the conversation ends. So comes along the son of the Rambam, Rambam, and he says, what is the meaning of this conversation? Listen to how peculiar it is. Hashem says, Moshe, go and deliver the following message. Moshe says, Hashem, I cannot speak normally. Hashem says, Aaron, your brother, will speak for you. Moshe turns to Hashem and says, but I cannot speak well. And Hashem says, no, Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet. What didn't he hear the first time? Why is the conversation repeated? Listen to what this great early authority says on this subject, which is, as he himself says, exquisite. He says he heard this explanation from his father, the Rambam, who brings it down from the Goyim, and he himself says this is a very precious and an unusually significant and beautiful explanation. And here's what he says. When Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, go and tell Pharaoh the following message, Moshe turned to Hashem and said, but I cannot speak normally. Hashem said, no problem, Aaron will speak for you. And then Moshe had a problem. And the problem was as follows. There's a law in the laws of prophecy that a prophet must speak his own prophecy, in fact, on pain of death. There's a law that when a prophecy comes down to a prophet, he's beholden. He's obliged to go out there and deliver that prophecy, and he must say it and no one else may. In fact, in Kabbalistic commentaries, is written that when a prophet receives a prophecy, all prophets on earth receive the same message at the same time, because they're tuned to the same wavelength, generally speaking, but they get it with his name on. And they all know who has to speak that message and that they may not. And they know that he must speak it out on pain of death. If a prophet tries not to say his prophecy, he suffers a dire consequence. How do we know that? From Yonah, who tried to refuse to say his prophecy. So he has to say it, and only he may say it. Some commentaries even say that those who can testify to a prophet not having done his duty are all other prophets, because they got the same message too and they know who's supposed to have said it. Therefore, the conversation goes like this. Let's interpolate those stages into the conversation. Hashem says, Moshe, go and deliver the following message. Moshe says, Hashem, but I cannot speak normally. Hashem says, don't worry, Aaron, your brother, will speak for you. So he turns to Hashem and he says, but Hashem, you wrote the rules. You know that that's not valid. In your own Torah, you've instructed us that a prophet must speak his own prophecy. What help will it be that I turn to my brother and I speak out my prophecy? It's utterly forbidden for a prophet to do that. He's not allowed to deliver his message through someone else. And Hashem says, you misunderstand me. I know the rules as well as you. I don't mean that you will speak your prophecy to a man called Aaron and he will speak it out for you. I don't mean that at all. In this case, you will be not the prophet, but you will be the prophecy. and Aaron your brother, Yeh Nevi'echa, he'll be the prophet. You must understand, you're not going to be a man receiving a message. You'll be the message. And your brother Aaron will be the prophet. And he will speak out a prophecy as any normal prophet would. An amazing explanation. In other words, what the Torah is telling us here, in the words of the Rambam and his son, is that Moshe Rabbeinu is not a prophet like others. Another prophet is a man who receives, a man, a woman receives a message, and refracted through his personality is the message. That's why the Torah says no two prophets speak in the same style, because each one receives the message and it's filtered, as it were, through his consciousness, and it comes out with his, when the music is played on the instrument resonates with the music according to its innate tone. But Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moses speaks, he opens his mouth, Shkinah medaberes mitoch ruach shel Moshe. He opens his mouth and what comes out is Hashem's word itself. There's no refraction. There's no spin. There's no style at all. It's fundamentally different. It's not just a clear reversion of prophecy. All other prophets in the world speak a message, to be sure Hashem's dictation, but they resonate, as it were, as if they were musical instruments resonating with the music that's being played on them. When it comes to Moshe Rabbeinu, there's no music. What he speaks is the word itself. You know how this is put in the technical terminology, that all prophets see through an aspaklaria she'ena ma'ira. That means a lens that is not completely clear. And Moshe Rabbeinu sees through aspaklaria ha'ma'ira, he sees through a lens that is completely clear. You know, Dessler famously used to explain this in the most beautiful Musa-style explanation. What's the difference between seeing through a lens that is clear and a lens that is cloudy? When you see through a lens that is clear, you see objectively through the lens. When you see through a lens that is cloudy, the cloudier the lens, the more reflection of yourself you see. And the dirtier the lens, the more you see yourself. But of course you don't know that. The dirtier your lens, the worse your ego, the more you see, think you're seeing objective reality. But of course it's more and more of a projection of yourself. But when that ego has been polished and that lens is completely clear, then you see the world as it is. And Moshe Rabbeinu's lens is the only one that is completely clear. As if to say there's no distortion at all. Not distortion, but not even a style, not even a... And therefore, there's a separate article of faith here. This article of faith is not simply that Moshe Rabbeinu is better or clearer, but he's categorically different. And it means that when you learn Torah, when you have access to Torah, Torah itself, the words of the prophets, come for particular purposes. And each one is the message delivered from Hashem through the medium of a particular personality. But when you learn Chumash, when you have access to Torah itself, as we move now towards Sinai, we're moving towards an experience where we make contact with the thing itself. This is not an intermediary in the normal sense, that he transmits the message as he transmits it. Here the message is, the medium and the message, if you like, have become one. You know, there are many consequences of this. Let me share with you just one. I want to keep you late. But Rav Simcha Wasserman, who taught us much of this, one of the applications he used to share with us is this. He used to say that the difference between Torah, Chumash, and Nach, any of the books of Torah that are subsequent to Chumash, the difference is fundamental and categorical. It's all the word of Hashem, there's no question. It's all the written law. But Chumash is fundamentally different in many ways. And one of the ways is this. He used to say, the ways to put it is like this. The Gemara says in Megillah, Tractate Megillah, the Gemara says, that when Nach was translated, when the 19 books of the Bible subsequent to Chumash were translated into Aramaic, there was an earthquake in Israel. 400 parsecs, which is the dimension of Israel, shook with an earthquake. Why? Because the translation is always problematic. There the Gemara gives an example. It says when they came to the words Bebikas Hadadrimon, which means in the valley of Hadadrimon, it's a place name. There was a problem translating that name. Because it's a place name. How do you translate the name of a place? Either you put it down as the Torah puts it, which is no translation, or you translate it, but then you have to reveal something that wasn't revealed in the original. After all, the name is not obvious to us what it means, but every word in Torah, every name in Torah has a very deep meaning. In this case, the meaning is not revealed. Well, what are you going to do? If you put the word down with no translation, you fail to make a translation. If you translate the word, then you've done what the original didn't do. An earthquake means an oscillation between two positions, right? That's the tension here. And therefore, unresolvable problem. That's what the Gemara says. Rav Simcha Wasserman used to say, how come when Chumash was translated there was no earthquake? When the Bible itself, when Torah itself was translated, there was no earthquake. Seems to be, and we have more than one Aramaic translation of the Torah. It's no problem. And he used to answer as follows. Because their words in Tanakh that suggests something hidden. But the craft in Chumash is that when the Torah hides something, it does it in a fundamentally different way. He used to put it like this. He used to say there are two ways to hide a thing. One way to hide a thing is called nister. Nister means hidden. But there's another way, and that's called mechuseh. Mechuseh means covered. What's the difference? I'll never forget this. You have to picture this image. He used to say, imagine I'm walking through customs. Now you have to imagine this great tzaddik trying to smuggle something through customs. But that's what he used to say. I'm walking through the customs, and I don't want the man to see that I have something. There are two ways to do it. One is I put it under my coat, and I walk through like this. He says, the fellow doesn't see what I have, but he sees I have something. But there's a different way to do it, is to sew it into the lining of your coat and walk through customs. The fellow doesn't see what I have, but he doesn't even see that I have anything. This is called mechuseh. It's covered. You can't see what it is, but you see there's something there. This is called nista. Nista means you don't even see that there's anything there in the first place. He used to say that in nach, the things that are hidden are mechuseh, they're covered. You come to a word, it's hard to translate. Something there. Meaning beneath meaning beneath meaning. You can see there's something there, you just don't see what it is. But Chumash, he said, is written in such a way that a six-year-old can read it from beginning to end and not even be aware that there's anything that's problematic. The craft in it, the cunning in it, he used to say, is so deep that it's in a completely different category. It's just one application. But in summary, what we studied this evening is the idea that Torah itself is, we have direct contact with Torah. You know, we always feel we're standing at Sinai, we heard only the first two commandments, the rest is given to us by an intermediary. The Rambam himself lays down the problem of intermediaries that is not fitting. We're allergic to the sense of intermediaries. We have problems with other systems that deal with and pray to intermediaries. Torah is not like that. There's an intermediary called Moshe Rabbeinu, but in one sense he's not an intermediary, and that's fundamental, it's axiomatic. Because without that axiom, the problem would be that we have no direct contact with Torah itself. And therefore, that is the process. Jewish people left Egypt, a fundamental and categorical stage. We transitioned from being a people who were unable to connect with the thing itself to a people who were able to connect with the thing in direct personal contact. You know, one of the great mysteries of the process leading from Pesach to Shavuot is, why do we keep going back to the Exodus? Why do we keep going back, Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim, we go back to the Exodus from Egypt? Why don't we go back to Matan Torah? Why are so many mitzvahs in the Torah, Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim? Because we went out of Egypt. Surely you name a journey for the point of destination, not the point of departure. Surely our personal meeting with Hashem at Sinai, that should be the defining moment. Surely the mitzvahs in the Torah, whether it's tefillin or taking interest or so many mitzvahs in Torah, we should say Zecher Lematan Torah. But we don't do that. We are defined by the Exodus. And the reason is because that was the watershed moment. When we left, we became able to receive. We became able to, you know, whether it's direct through hearing the words of Torah or whether it's indirect through mitzvahs. But we became a people at that moment who have the capacity to bond directly. As Rabbi Gottlieb spoke about Shir HaShirim, that he should kiss us with the kisses of his mouth. That means a direct and personal connection. Let me finish with an idea that I think puts this very clearly. You know, there's a very interesting problem that's raised by the Briskarov. He says that the Gemara in one particular section in Horius tries to derive what the first mitzvah was given to the Jewish people. What was the first mitzvah given to us? And the Gemara decides it must have been idolatry, faith in Hashem and idolatry at Sinai. The Gemara says, no, that wasn't the first mitzvah, because there were mitzvahs given a few weeks before at Marah. At Marah in the desert, the Jewish people left Egypt, 7 days later crossed the sea, a few days later came to Marah where they were given mitzvahs, Shabbos, Dinim, various other mitzvahs. So the Gemara says it cannot be correct that the first mitzvah was given at Sinai. Mitzvahs were given before in the desert. And that's the Gemara's conclusion. Ask the Briskarov, the Griz, in his Sefer on the Torah, why does the Gemara go back tomorrow? Why doesn't it go back to the mitzvahs in Egypt? I mean, if you're going to tell me that there were mitzvahs given before Sinai, why do you go back a few weeks tomorrow? Go back to the mitzvahs given in Egypt. What about Achoresh HaZelachem? This is the first of the months. Pesach, Matzah, Maror, Rosh Chodesh, and the whole calendar, the whole counting from Nisan, there were mitzvahs given in Egypt. He has no answer. But there's an amazing idea here that I heard from Ramosha Shapiro, but I'd like to share with you briefly and leave it at that, which shows that the transition from before leaving Egypt to after Egypt was so fundamental that we became utterly different. completely different, categorically different. There's a long discussion here, but I put it to you like this. There's a Zohar that says that when the Jewish people were in Egypt, they were eating matzah. Matzah means friction, strife. The Torah calls it lechem oni, that means the bread of affliction. You know, the word matzah in Hebrew means battle. It means disintegration. Ki yinatsu anashim, when people battle, when they strive. Matzah umariva means battle, breakdown, differentiation. That's what matzah means. And when they left, by the way, you know, it's fascinating, matzah represents two poles. In Egypt, it's the bread of affliction, and it's also the bread of redemption, right? We eat matzah because the bread couldn't rise when we left Egypt, and yet there was a commandment to eat matzah in Egypt before. Obviously, matzah is two. In Jewish thinking, the problem must always become the solution. Not a solution that defeats the problem. The problem must be shown to be the solution. Matzah is the bread of affliction, and matzah becomes the bread of redemption. But the Zohar puts it like this. The Zohar says when the Jewish people were in Egypt eating matzah, matzah was a woman without a man. That's what the Zohar says. It says a female without the male. A lonely female without the husband. So the Zohar says, when we left Egypt, Hashem, male, bonding with us, female, in that ultimate marital connection, gave us the letter of bonding. Right? In all Kabbalistic works, it's written that the Vav is the letter of bonding. In Hebrew, Vav means a hook. The letter Vav means and, which is a conjunction. And when we left Egypt, Hashem gave us the letter of Vav, which means connection, and matzah became mitzvah. Matzah became mitzvah. That's what it says. There's a long Zohar, explains it in much more detail, but what does it mean to us? It's no accident. You know, the Gemara says, Shmartem esam matzais, God the matzahs, read it, Shmartem esam mitzvois. Right? Not just a play on words. Then matzah became mitzvah. Matzah means breakdown. Mitzvah means bonding together. Mitzvah means a togetherness. That's what, the word does not mean commandment. In Hebrew, the word for a commandment is tzivui, not mitzvah. Mitzvah means a commandment that bonds, but savtachada means in one bond. In modern Hebrew, tzevet means a crew, people who operate together. Mitzvah means somehow a bonding. Matzah means breakdown, separation. Mitzvah means a connection. What's being said here? What's being said is this. Jewish people in Egypt, receiving instructions. Get instruction, it's tzivui. When they leave Egypt, they get instructions that aren't simply instructions. There's one who commands and one who's commanded. You know the construction in Hebrew, when you put a mem in front of a word, you have a shofet, a judge, you have a nishpat, the one who's being judged. When the process unites them, you have mishpat. That's what the letter does. Or you have, for example, a malve, a lender, a loive, a borrower. Put them together, you get a milve. You put that letter in front, you get the conjunction. Right? Mitzvah means tzivui, where the one who commands and the one who's commanded have meshed into one. There's a unification. In Egypt, those were different sort of mitzvahs. The mitzvahs in Egypt, the Rambam lists together with the mitzvahs of the non-Jews. He lists them in the same category. In fact, I can't resist telling you, this is too beautiful to miss. Do you know that in the Rambam he writes that mankind was given six mitzvahs, Adam was given six mitzvahs, Noah was given a seventh, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob each added a mitzvah, and then the Rambam says something very peculiar. He says, "Ube Mitzrayim, and in Egypt, Nitztave Amram, that Amram, the father of Moshe, was given other mitzvahs. Nitztave Amram be mitzvahs, Yisraelis. Amram was given other mitzvahs. Ad Sheba Moshe Rabbeinu, until Moshe came, v'nishlam haTorah al Yadoi, and the Torah was completed." And this taxes the commentators greatly. Nitztave Amram, Amram was commanded with mitzvahs. Where's the source for that? Where did the Rambam see that Amram was given mitzvahs? There are very creative suggestions about it, but it's a very difficult problem. Recently, someone discovered an unknown text, a text of the Korban Asanel, one of the great commentators of the last few hundred years, the rabbi in Karlsruhe, 300 years ago, and he has an edition of the Rambam that doesn't have that word. In his Rambam, it doesn't say Nitztave Amram, it says Nitztave Imahem, just a dot of ink. It doesn't mean that Amram was commanded. His edition, the Korban Asanel's Rambam, says, Nitztavu Imahem, that the Jewish people in Egypt were commanded like the non-Jews and Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were commanded, in that category of mitzvahs. The Gemara in Horius doesn't want to go back to the mitzvahs given in Egypt. That was a different category of mitzvah. What the Jewish people were given in Egypt was instructions. An instruction means there's an instructor and one who obeys. Does it mean they function together? No. The general of the army orders the private to do something. Doesn't mean that they form a bond. He probably hates him. He might die. Doesn't mean that. When we left Egypt, we became categorically different. When the sea split and we were born again, formed anew, we became people where the instructor and the one who's instructed become one. There's a meshing here into a oneness. That's the meaning of mitzvah. You know, I'm going to keep you for another 2 minutes. You can fire me, Rabbi Salinger. You know that crossing the ocean was that defining moment. You know what it means to cross the ocean? The deep commentaries say that the water splitting of the ocean was a woman's waters splitting and giving birth. When the waters break and the child is born, that's what happened to us in crossing the ocean. In fact, it's very clear that we went into the ocean only for that experience. They didn't cross any place. The Medrash says they went in and came out the same side. There's no place to cross. Look at the map. They didn't cross over. They went into the ocean to be born in the ocean. What does this mean? Maral explains that when the world was formed, it was covered in water. Water means that material void of form. There's no form. Water has no form. Water is just material. In fact, that's why in Hebrew, water is only plural. There's no singular water. There's no singularity to water. By the way, it's very interesting. If there is a singularity to water, mayim, it's ma. Ma means what? What means, when you can't say what a thing is, you simply say, what is it? When the manna fell, they couldn't say what it was, so they called it, what is it? Man means what is it? The Ramban says that the man was crystallized Shekhinah. The manna was God's presence crystallized. You can't name that, so they called it, what is it? Ma means what is it? Mayim means, what is this? Plural. By the way, very interesting to think. In many languages, you see that this Hebrew idea has sparked into a number of languages. Ma means what? Mayim is water. In the Germanic languages, was is what? And wasser is water. In the Dutch group of languages, wat is what? And water is water. In Latin, qua is what? And aqua is water. Very interesting. Right? A lot of food for thought here. How Hebrew spiritualism has sparked into all the derivative languages on earth. But water is the water split, revealed dry land, and that's where the Jewish people are formed. That's where mankind is formed, ultimately, originally. What happens when mankind perverts its way in the world? There's a flood, back to water, back to the material void of form, and a new edition of humanity emerges. And what happens when mankind perverts its way again? There's another splitting of the ocean. And what happens is the water split, and the Jewish people are a third edition of humanity. Right? And there's no accident that it's a revelation in waters that have split. You know, the Gaon of Vilna once was asked a question, a fascinating question. I'll leave you with this as a final take. Reb Chaim Volozhin, his main Talmud, once went in to speak to the Gaon of Vilna. And he went as a special treat. He took his little son, Reb Yitzhak, with him, maybe 7 years old. And Reb Chaim asked the Gaon all his questions. And one of the questions he asked the Gaon of Vilna was this. He said to him, it says that when the ocean returned to its form, it says, V'chazah hayom le'esonoi, the waters returned to their might. But the word esonoi, says the Medrash, can be read as letna'oi harishon. That means the waters returned to the condition that had been made with them originally. The Medrash, the Mechilta says, the Medrash in Bereishis says, that when Hashem created the ocean, He created with a condition, that it shall be horizontal, but when required shall stand miraculously vertically. And he made a condition in the original creation of the oceans. The Maharal discusses why was the condition necessary, but that's what it says. Sedrup Chaim Volozhin said to the Gaon of Vilna, if there was a condition made with the ocean when it was created, that one day it would stand miraculously, where do we see the condition? Where in the description of creation do you see that the ocean was created conditionally? Where does the verse say, so everything must be in Torah? Before the Gaon could answer, the little boy tugged at his father's sleeve. Tati, why do you ask the tzaddik? Why don't you ask me? I'm probably trying to put him in his pocket or under the table. I don't know what he did. But the Gaon picked him up and he put him on a chair and he said, speak. And the little boy said, I'll tell you where it says it in Bereishis. The verse says, when the oceans were created, Yikavu hamayim mitachas lashamayim emakam echon. Let all the waters under heavens be gathered unto one place. V'seyiroi hayabasha, and let the dry land be revealed. So the child said, if all the waters under heavens are gathered unto one place, of course the dry land is revealed. Why does there have to say, and let the dry land be revealed? Those words refer to a second time dry land is going to be revealed, in a second splitting of waters, namely where the Jewish people are formed. And the Gaon kissed him on his head and he said, that's correct. Bad for 7 years old. But you see, what I'm not sure the child understood is the meaning. The meaning is that there was more than one time that the ocean split. The first time is the idea of separation of waters, the gathering of waters. This is where mikveh comes from. And there's an addition of mankind that is formed. The Jewish people enter the ocean to become another edition of mankind. And it's a birth process. where the water split. You're going back, if you like, into that Shfir Mesha, fear, that primal waters of creation, and the Jewish people are categorically changed. From then on, we become a people who are able to hear an instruction and bond with the one who instructs. We were able to move towards Sinai and hear Torah, where we're not hearing a Torah distant and transmitted through intermediary, but we're able to hear the message itself. And therefore, as we move towards Shavuos in the next few weeks, the journey is not simply a journey of intellectual development or coming to know things better. This is a journey from a situation of fracture, of separation, of differentiation. It's a journey towards a bonding into oneness, whether it's through mitzvahs, where the concept of matzah has become mitzvah, and the one who commands and the one who's commanded are one, or whether it's through the ability to hear Torah and know that we're not hearing here a message, but we're hearing a oneness between medium and message. Thank you very much.